Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith. We look at big lies and big oil. Republican John McCain has been getting a lot of mileage out of his demands for U.S. drilling, which he says will reduce oil prices.
We're not going to pay $4 a gallon for gas because we're going to drill offshore, and we're going to drill here, and we're going to drill now.
McCain speaking to motorcycle enthusiasts at the Sturgis rally in South Dakota. It's a false argument, according to our guest Nick Burning of Friends of the Earth.
It's simply lying for Senator McCain to say that we're going to see price impacts in months from drilling, and he knows better.
He joins us to correct the record on John McCain and Democrat Barack Obama about offshore drilling. And Paul Waldman of Media Matters joins us to discuss the recent surge in coverage of John McCain due to his negative campaign messages and the matter of lies in a new book about Barack Obama.
Jerome Corsi just this week is coming out with another book. This time, it's an attack on Barack Obama, and it too is filled with falsehood.
Longtime environmentalists have been expressing frustration with recent news coverage about offshore drilling. They want more details provided, such as the facts contained in a report from the Energy Information Administration, which was requested by Alaska Senator Ted Stevens back in 2007. It showed drilling in the Arctic refuge will have no effect on gas prices. The report said after years of development, by 2018, opening Anwar to drilling could mean another 780,000 barrels per day by 2027, and it's downhill from there, and that's only a fraction of the 21 million barrels a day the U.S. uses. The Alaska Wilderness League points out that 91 million acres of land is already available in Alaska's Arctic region that could be leased for oil production, yet only 11.8 million are being used. These unused acres could produce more than six times the estimated peak production from the sought-after Arctic Wildlife Refuge. The problem for environmental activists is that the President George Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney have created a gold rush climate for big oil companies. The big companies took in profits of $120 billion last year alone. And so their goal has become one of land domination while the getting is good.
This is just a classic example of what I mean by disaster capitalism, which is using a real disaster, using a real crisis or a shock, like the oil shock, to push through policies that you can't get through during normal circumstances. So here you have a shock. You have a real oil crisis. People are in pain. They want solutions. And you've got the president, the extortionist in chief, whose job is to actually solve the problems, but instead he holds the country hostage. And he says, listen, unless you give me Anwar, you'll never drive again.
That was Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine, on Fox Network. The oil industry has become powerful by spending lavishly on lobbying and also on advertising and public relations. ExxonMobil became famous for investing in a media campaign to discredit global warming scientists, and in 2007 alone, they spent $100 million on ads, largely to claim they were investing in alternative energy resources. In fact, according to the Alaska Wilderness League, Exxon spent 10 times more on advertising than it did on investments in renewable energy. The group's August 5th press release also points out that those friendly to big oil companies tend to receive large donations. House Republican leader John Boehner of Ohio, they say, accepted more than $600,000 in campaign contributions from the energy sector during his career. And Republican John McCain has gotten a recent boost in income from big oil after reversing himself on offshore drilling. Writing for Talking Points Memo, Greg Sargent and Eric Kleefield point out a report from the Federal Election Commission noting 10 members of the Hess Oil family or Hess Corporation executives gave $28,500 to the joint RNC-McCain fundraising committee just days after McCain reversed himself to favor offshore drilling. According to the Washington Post, oil industry executives contributed some $1.1 million to McCain's presidential campaign in July after his reversal on offshore drilling. And on Wednesday the 6th, the Post's Matthew Mosk revealed former naval officer Harry Sargent III, owner of an oil trading company that recently got defense contracts worth potentially $1 billion, has become a money man for John McCain, collecting money to bundle through the RNC. Individual donors give maximum amounts, and Sargent bundles them together into larger figures for McCain. According to Mosk, Sargent's connections include the CIA. And while the law forbids high-level supporters from writing huge checks, says Mosk, Sargent's friends in the Middle East and the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, now a consultant to Sargent's company, helped bring in $100,000 for three presidential candidates, John McCain, Hillary Clinton, and Rudy Giuliani. California Democrat Henry Waxman is looking into Sargent's military contracts. Waxman mentioned an intriguing letter of authorization for Sargent from the Jordanian government to move fuel across its territory to Iraq. Sargent admits to having a vast network of people to turn to for funds. John McCain accepted public campaign financing, but he can still receive money through the RNC, Republican National Committee, and heads of major corporations like Connecticut hedge fund billionaire Ray Dalio of Bridgewater Corporation have been helping McCain out generously. Dalio organized one event for wealthy residents in Connecticut, a private fundraiser, and another quote-unquote town meeting attended by 400 of his employees. McCain took the opportunity to assure them he wouldn't rule out more preemptive wars. President Bush's preemption doctrine was designed to circumvent Congress and the American people for a U.S. invasion of oil-rich Iraq in 2003. Nick Burning of Friends of the Earth has said John McCain is turning his back on the planet by pushing for offshore drilling. Nick Burning, welcome.
Thank you.
Just go over your complaints about John McCain's recent policy on offshore drilling.
You know, had you talked to John McCain himself in May of 2008, just a month earlier, he could have told you what was wrong with the policy, and in fact, he did. At a campaign event in Wisconsin in May of this year, McCain was talking about why offshore drilling isn't a real solution, because it would take years to access that oil, and even then, there's simply not enough oil to make a real dent in prices. And the real problem here is our over-reliance on fossil fuels, and real solutions are going to be finding ways to reduce our use on fossil fuels and through efficiency and also finding other sources of energy. So when he flip-flopped on this in June, that was a big deal. On several different areas, he's moved away from previous support of environmentally beneficial stands, and it's really distressing. This whole idea of offshore drilling solving the energy problem, every expert says it's not going to happen. It's really a distraction. And we need to be thinking big and talking in big ways about how are we going to transition to clean energy. And McCain signaled he wasn't really interested in doing that.
Now here, thanks to the magic of the internet, is audio of John McCain's comments in Greensdale, Wisconsin. Huffington Post put them up. And here McCain is answering a question about offshore drilling by saying that there are considerations about land and states' rights, adding that it's not offshore drilling, but alternative energy development that is important, and talking about the limitations in terms of the time it would take to get the oil out of the ground.
With those resources, which would take years to develop, if we only postpone or temporarily relieve our dependency on fossil fuels, we are going to have to go to alternate energy.
Nick, first, what is wrong with offshore drilling? Why is it a problem?
From a basic environmental perspective, it's just not safe. And the reason we got a lot of the bans that are now in place is because of a legacy of spills some decades ago. And there's still a risk of oil spills. When Hurricanes Rita and Katrina came up through the Gulf a couple of years ago, for example, there were numerous incidents where there was spillage of oil. But also now the challenge we're facing is a much broader one. Our country is really in the midst of a big energy crisis. Not only are gas prices and energy prices going up, we're also dependent on other nations for our energy, and certainly our need for foreign oil has played into the Iraq War and other conflicts. And probably the biggest long-term problem of all is, as we're burning all these fossil fuels, we're releasing greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and warming the planet, and that's going to have a ton of consequences as we move forward. At a broader level, the problem with drilling is it's actually increasing our dependence on these same fossil fuels that are causing all these problems rather than finding alternatives.
Now, as you said, some things have changed since 2006 in terms of America's energy policy and what's going on with alternatives. But let's listen to another clip of this time Illinois Senator Barack Obama back in March of 2006 as he was criticizing the president for failing to fund some portions of the energy bill that would have addressed alternative energy development. He mentions offshore drilling and big oil.
And while he can't seem to find the funding for any of these alternative fuel proposals. He has no problem allowing the oil companies to stiff taxpayers $7 billion in royalties that they owe us for drilling on public lands. These are the same oil companies that are currently enjoying the highest profits on record. That's not a serious energy policy. Let me suggest what could be a serious energy policy. Brazil, in the span of 3 years, has gone from 3% of its cars being flexible fuel vehicles that can use ethanol and other biofuels to 71% of the cars on the road being flexible fuel vehicles that you can use ethanol and other biodiesel fuels in their cars. As a consequence, Brazil, a nation that once relied on foreign countries to import 80% of its crude oil, will now be entirely self-sufficient in a few years.
Now, as you know, there's a new energy bill from a bipartisan group of senators who've introduced a proposal to, they say, reduce gas prices by opening new areas in the Southeast Atlantic Ocean and Eastern Gulf of Mexico to oil and gas drilling. They say they would raise taxes, too, on major oil companies. Does Barack Obama support this new so-called Group of 10 bill?
Thankfully, Senator Obama hasn't gone quite so far as to say he supports the proposal, and he's still said that he thinks offshore drilling is a bad idea. He's correct. He says it's not going to actually do anything to reduce the cost of gas. It'll take too long to get to those resources, and then there's simply not enough oil offshore to actually do anything. So thankfully, he still says he doesn't support the idea. But what is troubling is Senator Obama has now said he's open to a compromise on that to get something broader done. And he did welcome this proposal from these other senators. And what we're working to do now is to persuade him not to support that proposal. We think it's wrongheaded and it's a bad compromise, not just because of drilling, but it also actually contains a number of other bad things. And we're actually encouraging Senator Obama to focus on his own plans that he's put forward, which are much better and which invest seriously in renewable energy and efficiency and would help us transition away from fossil fuels. And actually, Friends of the Earth Action, our political entity, endorsed early on in the primary process former Senator John Edwards. He was the first candidate to put forward a bold plan to fight global warming, and he had a lot of innovative ideas. And he also spoke out strongly about the dangerous and growing influence that corporations and corporate power is having on government.
Well, there's been a recent debate about price fixing on the part of oil corporations, but what are some of the biggest factors causing oil prices to go up?
It's simply not possible when you have a limited resource to keep using more and more of it and think it won't run out. And that's sort of the fantasy, actually, in some ways, both parties have been embracing. You have Republicans, in large part, arguing that we can drill more and drill our way out of it. That's not true. You've also got a lot of Democrats in Congress actually talking about cracking down on oil speculators. And while speculation could be playing some role in the prices, probably what's actually the biggest impact is the fact that China is using much more oil. A lot of the oil-producing nations, like Saudi Arabia, have been buying a lot more cars and driving more and using more oil. And the real problem here is demand is going up around the world. Supply remains limited, and there is no quick fix that's going to lower gas prices. The real answer is to reduce our dependence on oil and gas and start switching to other fuels and having more efficient vehicles and creating more alternatives to driving in the first place, public transportation, walkable and bikeable communities, those sorts of things. If you can take a subway or ride a bus to work every day, you may still drive the car on the weekend to go shopping, but you certainly need to pay for a lot less gas. So part of the solution is we need to provide those alternatives and make sure they're affordable. And the government definitely has a role in promoting that. Also, once you start seeing fewer vehicles on the road and less gas being used, that actually lowers the price of gas. Of course, the whole law of supply and demand. So there are some short-term things we can do that will make a difference in gas prices a bit. But I think we also need to be honest with ourselves. We're never going to get back to that $2 gallon of gas. Demand continues to rise around the world, and the ultimate solutions here are long-term ones. They're not easy, but they are doable, and we certainly have the technical know-how and economic ability to achieve them. And what we've got to be doing is ending our reliance on fossil fuels altogether, giving people options to get out of their cars, electrifying transportation, and then making sure that we have a clean power electric grid that's fueled primarily with wind, solar, geothermal, and other clean renewable forms of energy.
I know Barack Obama has also argued for a new grid and a digital grid. Can you just discuss the state of the nation's energy grid?
Part of what we need is the ability to transport energy to different places across the country. One reason, for example, most of the best wind generating areas in the United States are up through the center of the country. There's sort of a big swath of the country that runs from Texas up north to the Dakotas and Minnesota. Yet most of our big cities and population centers are on or near the coast. And the current electric grid that we have isn't up to the task of transporting power from those places or from desert areas where you could generate a lot of solar power easily. It isn't up to the task of transporting that power to the cities where we would need to use it. So certainly we need to improve our electric grid. We also need smart grids. So let's say you had a solar panel at your own home. At peak hours, you should be able to sell that power back to the utility, and you would actually serve as a source of clean power generation. But then we also simply need investments in actual sources of power. So we need to be building a lot more wind turbines. You can have massive solar arrays where you have mirrors sending heat up to a single point where you're heating water and generating a lot of electricity that way. What we're talking about is investments of hundreds of billions of dollars. Senator Obama's actually proposed a new Apollo Energy plan where he'd take $150 billion over the next 10 years and invest it in just these sorts of solutions. And that would be a really good start in terms of getting us on this track to ending our reliance on fossil fuels.
Nick Burning of Friends of the Earth, have you had a lot of press attention since this became a hot-button issue in the political race?
We've had a fair amount of coverage, but I think sometimes there's a tendency in the media to tell stories in a he-said-she-said manner. And so you'll get one candidate, for example, saying, well, I don't support drilling, and here's why. And then you'll get another candidate that says, well, I do support drilling, and it's going to lower the price of gas right away. Which, in fact, just last week, Senator McCain was down in Florida saying that he thought within months we would see lower prices due to offshore oil drilling. The media have a tendency to portray this as sort of, well, here's what he said, and it has equal weight to what the other person said, when sometimes things are just factually true or untrue. And in that case, it's just not factually true. Every single expert says we're not going to be able to get to this new offshore oil for a decade or more, and even when we do, it'll barely impact prices. The big L word, lie, is a word the media often doesn't like to go to, but it's simply lying for Senator McCain to say that we're going to see price impacts in months from drilling. And he knows better, and it would be good to see the media respond, you know, when he says things that are factually untrue. I think reporters have an obligation to inform their readers or listeners of what the actual facts are, and we certainly could stand to see some more of that.
Nick Burning of Friends of the Earth, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Joining us next is Paul Waldman, a senior fellow and director of special projects at Media Matters for America. He has authored or co-authored four books on media and politics, including this year's Free Ride, John McCain and the Media. Paul Waldman, welcome.
Thank you.
It's gotten a little uglier, hasn't it? Why don't we start there? What have you noticed about recent media coverage of the campaign that has struck you as, let's say, over the top?
You know, one of the things that conservatives always complain about is the idea that there's a liberal bias in the media. I don't think that's true, but I think one of the clearest biases that you do see in the media is a bias toward the negative and toward conflict. If you've been watching cable news recently, you've probably seen a lot of McCain ads on being replayed on cable news again and again and again, basically giving them free airtime. But you haven't seen all that many Obama ads. And the reason is not that there's some kind of a conservative bias or a Republican bias on cable news. The reason is that most of McCain's ads that he's airing right now are negative ads that are targeting Obama, whereas most of the ads that Obama is airing right now are positive ones. And furthermore, the ones that the news media really eats up are ads that are about character, not about policy. Obama has an ad where he's attacking John McCain on the issue of energy. And they'll put that on cable a couple times, but it won't engender all that much discussion. On the other hand, the McCain campaign ads that falsely charged that Obama refused to meet with troops if he couldn't bring cameras, or the McCain ad that pairs Obama with Britney Spears and Paris Hilton, those aren't about issues. Those are more personal, and that's what really gets the press's attention. And so I think the McCain campaign has figured out that they can get a whole bunch of free media coverage and basically get their ads played for free if they make more personal attacks. You know, some people at the beginning of the campaign said, oh, you know, John McCain is a principled guy. He's never going to do that sort of thing. And even now, we see a lot of people in the press trying to find some other explanation for it. Say, well, maybe his campaign is doing it without him barely even knowing about it, that it's the influence of all these Karl Rove proteges who are now running the McCain campaign, but it's not a real reflection of what he stands for, which is kind of ridiculous. I mean, it's the guy at the top is the one who's ultimately responsible, but when it comes to McCain, they try to find ways to explain it away. And I think that what it shows is that the McCain campaign is very good at exploiting those actual biases that the press has, the bias toward negativity, the bias toward the personal. That's what they're exploiting very effectively.
Now, in May, John McCain completely reverses his position on offshore drilling, yet Barack Obama winds up tagged the flip-flopper. How did that happen?
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. What Obama said was that if it was part of a compromise that's currently being debated in Congress as a way of getting more money for alternative energy and conservation and other kinds of things, if it was part of that compromise, then he would be willing to give a little bit on offshore drilling. That's what compromise is. You accept something you don't really like in order to get something that you want. But again and again, we've seen that characterized as him changing his position or even flip-flopping. You know, the truth is that he hasn't changed his position at all. Like, that's what a compromise is. But we've noticed this a lot, is that when Obama has even sometimes just changed his emphasis or talked about an issue that he hasn't spoken about in a while, there's a lot of discussion in the press about this idea that he's flip-flopping, whereas McCain has genuinely done 180s on a whole series of issues. You know, he used to be against the Bush tax cuts. Now he's for them and he wants to extend them permanently. At first he was for comprehensive immigration reform. Then he flipped during the primaries and said he wanted to secure the borders and that was the most important priority, in contradiction of what he had said before. He even said he wouldn't vote for his own bill on immigration. And now he seems to be kind of edging back. But those things don't tend to get characterized as flip-flops when it comes to John McCain, because so many in the media who decided a long time ago that he was their favorite politician, they just believe that John McCain has so much integrity that he's incapable of flip-flopping. And so when he actually does, they tend to ignore it.
John McCain was fairly successful with his Dr. No campaign, and Rasmussen has the polls well over 60% of Americans who now think offshore drilling is the answer to high gas prices. More or less reminiscent of the run-up to the Iraq War, isn't it?
Well, it just goes to show that, you know, when people are hurting and they're upset, what sounds like a nice, easy solution is something that can have a wide appeal. It's not the first time or the last time that people have basically been fooled into thinking that something that is not going to actually solve the problem will, in fact, solve the problem. You know, you don't get a lot of points in the context of a campaign for being thoughtful and realistic. You get points for pushing people's buttons and offering the quick fix. And so, you know, it's not too surprising to anyone who's been paying attention to presidential campaigns for the last 200 years or so. But if the press was doing a better job, then it wouldn't be so easy to fool people into thinking that something like offshore drilling is really going to solve their energy problems. In large part, what happened during the run-up to the war was that the press just took what the administration was saying at face value. And if they ever bothered to check whether it was true, those analyses ended up being buried on, you know, page 17 of the newspaper, if they actually got any kind of circulation at all. But the fact that the administration said it was good enough for most of the media. Now, in a campaign, it may not be that they're making the same kind of judgment about what's true and what's false, but the fact that one campaign says it is a good enough reason, as far as they're concerned, to put it on the front page, to put it on the evening news. You know, for example, this ad that McCain aired that charged falsely that Obama had not gone to see wounded soldiers because he wasn't going to be allowed to take cameras there. That was false. And in a lot of those discussions, what you saw is, on TV, for instance, they would show the ad. They would then have a discussion about its political effects, and somewhere along the line, somebody might say, oh yeah, and by the way, the charge is completely false. But the point was to repeat what McCain was saying and talk about what the politics were going to be. And so in the same way, the actual truth got buried if it was mentioned at all. So there is, in that way, some similar things going on.
Let's turn to the Jerome Corsi book, The Obama Nation. You point out in Media Matters that the 2004 book, Unfit for Command, also contained lots of untruths. That one, of course, was about former Democratic candidate John Kerry. How does Corsi get away with this?
What happened in 2004 was really, more than anything else, a failure of the press. You had the Swiftboat Veterans for Truth coming out with a whole series of lies about John Kerry, that he didn't deserve his medals, that he faked his injuries. It was completely untrue. And one of the figures at the heart of this was a guy named Jerome Corsi, who co-wrote the book Unfit for Command, which was the smear attack on John Kerry. By the time the press got around to investigating the charges and determining whether or not they were true, they had already been talking about them for about a month. And so they circulated widely before they were finally debunked. And now we're seeing that Jerome Corsi just this week is coming out with another book. This time it's an attack on Barack Obama. And it too is filled with falsehoods. And you're also talking about, in Corsi, a guy who we have up on our website, MediaMatters.org, a whole series of posts that he put up on right-wing websites calling Muslims ragheads and calling Chelsea Clinton chubby Chelsea, all kinds of infantile, bigoted stuff that this guy has been throwing around for a while. And yet, what's happening? Well, he's being interviewed on Fox News and on MSNBC. Once again, instead of assessing whether or not his charges are false or true, and when they're found to be false, saying, well, we're not going to give you free publicity, they are first initiating the discussion, giving him the publicity about his book, so it'll no doubt rise to the top of the bestseller lists. And then I suppose eventually they'll get around to looking at the charges, in which case they will probably find that they're false. It really looks, although it's just starting, like they're going to commit the same mistake that they committed 4 years ago.
Now, in 1997, Barack Obama voted against a bill that defined a fetus as a person, but it was specific about criminalizing partial birth abortion, that highly rare procedure, which most often has to do with profound illnesses where the mother is sick or the child cannot possibly survive. But this was how Jerome Corsi characterized that vote August 1st on Fox's Hannity's America.
If the child's born, he said, the woman still had the right to kill the child.
And this and other audio on MediaMatters.org. Paul Waldman?
What he's done is take a vote that Obama made on a pretty complicated abortion bill when he was an Illinois senator and use it to try to claim that Barack Obama basically favors infanticide. And it's this kind of thing where, upon any kind of examination, the charge is just ridiculous. But they're going to use that, and I'm sure that no doubt it will be turning up in millions of emails being sent out to people in the hopes that people who are opposed to abortion rights, and even people who are kind of in the middle in favor of some abortion rights, will be appalled and disgusted when they find out that this person is claiming that Barack Obama favors allowing people to commit infanticide. The fact that it's just false is almost going to be irrelevant. And that's true with so many of the attacks on Obama that we've seen circulating around in those emails and on right-wing websites. They're the most kind of ridiculous, inflammatory things, and yet people believe them. The silliest one I've seen is this charge that he wasn't actually born in the United States. There are actually, you know, millions of emails circulating around saying that, and people believe it. He says in the book that Obama, you know, admits that he did drugs, but he never actually says when he stopped doing drugs, and that's just not true. You know, in Barack Obama's own book, he talks about how when he was a college student, he stopped doing drugs. There are things like that that are just throughout this book that even a few minutes of research would have convinced the author or anybody looking at it that they're just false. But the point of this is political. The point is to try to destroy him. It's yet another campaign of character assassination. And so this is not, you know, undertaken by somebody who has any kind of commitment to being accurate and being thorough. It's about character assassination. And frankly, if the media continues on the way they've been going, it may be successful.
Finally, Connecticut's independent senator, Joe Lieberman, has come to the defense of John Hagee, the hard-right televangelist. He endorsed John McCain. What do you make of the coverage?
One question I wish that a reporter had asked McCain is, you know, when some of the things that Hagee has said came to light after McCain went down to San Antonio twice to go beg for his endorsement, and some of Hagee's more inflammatory statements about Hurricane Katrina being God's punishment for a gay pride parade. He said something about how God caused the Holocaust in order to convince Jews to go to Israel. When all that happened, John McCain said, oh, well, you know, of course I don't believe any of that stuff. And he ended up sort of retracting his seeking of Hagee's endorsement. But no reporter said, well, doesn't that just show, if you don't agree with the things that this guy says, that it was nothing but cynical politics for you to go down and ask for his endorsement, if you either knew nothing about him or knew about him but didn't agree with what he said? Those aren't the kind of questions that John McCain gets from reporters. You know, we could talk forever about what this means for the Republican Party and the religious right, but it was one more example of where John McCain just has a different set of rules that the press asks him to play by.
Paul Waldman, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Paul Waldman, a senior fellow and director of special projects at Media Matters for America, MediaMatters.org. He is co-author of the book Free Ride, John McCain and the Media. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program was produced in the studios of WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live Wednesdays at 5 p.m. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.